Ukrainians in Kherson singing their national anthem to celebrate liberation from Russian occupation. It's Monday, November 14th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Later in the show, we'll hear about a plan to erase medical debt in Toledo, Ohio, and how voters in New Mexico last week approved more funding for early childhood education. First, though, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made a surprise visit to Kherson today, where Ukrainians have taken to the streets to cheer the retreat of Russian soldiers after more than 8 months of occupation. But the war is far from over, and basic services in Kherson, like power, water, and communications, are still down. NPR's Frank Langfitt was with Ukrainian troops in the region earlier this fall, and he stayed in touch with soldiers there. Today, he checked in with us. Here's his conversation with Eric Westervelt.
Frank, really an extraordinary development in the war, perhaps Ukraine's biggest success so far in pushing back Russian troops. What have you been hearing?
Well, I've been in touch with some of these soldiers, as you were saying, and one of them is a guy named Colonel Roman Kostenko. I first met him actually back in April, and he is from Kherson, a small village. The Russians came in, not only took the village, but they also lived in his house. Mm-hmm. And on Friday, he was able to actually go home for the first time, and he sent me this video in which he walks into his front yard. He sees this broken window. He wipes away tears, and then he goes inside, and almost everything's gone. The Russians have taken his body armor, his medals. They've just left a grenade. But he's got this flag, and at the end, it's flying from a trellis in his front yard. And when I talked to him this weekend, he just said he was really proud to be back in his house.
Yeah, really, really a bittersweet scene there where he's going into his liberated village, but it's, you know, also destroyed. And you see people weeping, and it's extraordinary. Frank, the city's struggling to restore some basic services, but there seems to be a real sense of optimism despite the real heavy toll on civilians and soldiers. What other stories are you hearing from people there?
You know, when people got back to actually Kherson City, I mean, they were very excited, and we saw those remarkable images over the weekend. There's another guy that I know, a recon officer who goes by the battle nickname Fox, and for him, it was also kind of an extraordinary journey. He left the day of the invasion from Kherson City. He was actually a seaman who worked on a cargo ship out of the port there. He flees, and then he joins the army, becomes a drone operator, and actually helps target those HIMAR rockets from the Americans that have proved so effective. Well, he returns to his neighborhood over the weekend, and he gets this hero's welcome, especially because he actually hadn't told any of his neighbors that he had actually joined the army.
They was completely surprised, of course. I didn't tell them because it can make some problem, because they wasn't occupied territory.
He didn't want the Russians, of course, to take vengeance on them because he was a soldier. And he said of this homecoming, it was one of the happiest moments of his entire life.
Happy moments, but we are told city residents can hear the thud, thud, thud of artillery fairly nearby. So the fighting in the Kherson region is clearly not over. What more do we know about the Russian retreat, Frank?
Well, you know, a vast majority of the Russians fled across the east bank of the Dnieper River, and this was to avoid being annihilated from the Ukrainians, who had really cut off their supply lines. But Ukrainians are still concerned that there are Russians in Ukrainian-controlled territory. They're hunting for them now. But overall, as you said, this is one of the biggest setbacks of the war for the Russians.
Mm. Frank, you've been learning some more about the Russian-installed deputy governor of Kherson, who recently died, apparently in a car crash. Who was he, and what was his role in Kherson?
Yeah, I kind of found him fascinating. His name is Kirill Stramusov, and he was a civic activist, a pro-Russian blogger. And I think early on in his career, I talked to people who had worked with him, as well as Ukrainian intelligence. And he was kind of a political gadfly, but he did do some good things for people. He, you know, would help them when the local officials wouldn't put out enough salt and get rid of the snow, and also expose local businesses who wouldn't get permits for buildings. But some of his associates told me that he became kind of a shakedown artist, and he was extorting money from businessmen. And then they think the Russians recruited him well before the invasion. What was really striking, Eric, is they made him a spokesman for the occupation, and he did these tons of videos predicting the Russian victory, things like that, saying Kherson was a part of Russia. Some of it pretty odd stuff. This is something that he put out in which he sort of wrote a poem and performed it to music. Let's take a listen. And what he has is there images of cities like Prague and Budapest, and he says, you know, all of this is going to become Russia. And it was very strange. It was also very strange in some ways that the Russians would use somebody like this, who was a marginal figure, to be their public face.
Wow. I mean, that video, just watching it, I mean, it's just this bizarre sort of ultra-nationalist fantasy. I mean, it's incredible.
And I think people there saw him as a bit of a buffoon. Hmm. But the insights that I got were kind of interesting. People who'd worked with him and knew Kherson said he was a part of a really corrupt culture there, and that actually made it easier for the Russians to infiltrate.
Frank, it's alleged he was killed in a car crash. Is there any reason to believe it was anything other than a car crash?
I don't think so. Again, I've been in touch with the Ukrainian intelligence, and they were surprised by it, so they weren't behind it. It is a dangerous place to drive. It's in the middle of war, and there were video of his vehicle on its top, but there's been no direct allegations that he was assassinated.
Frank, looking ahead, well, what's next for Kherson and really for the war more broadly after this victory for Ukraine?
Well, I think for Kherson, it's restoring all those things that you were saying. But the real challenge for them is, with the Russians just on the other side of the river, they're in artillery range. Mm-hmm. So I think they're very anxious that they're going to get hammered by the Russians, who now have a river to protect themselves. And in the longer run, I think we're heading into winter. It is hard to fight in the winter. It's very muddy down there, Eric. And so things will probably slow. So the kinds of tremendous advances we've seen up in Kharkiv and now in Kherson, probably not going to be able to see those kinds of advances by the Ukrainians in the coming winter months.
It's NPR's Frank Langford in London. Frank, as always, thank you.
Hey, great to talk, Eric.
Coming up next, how one city is using public money to wipe out more than $200 million in medical debt. Stick around. More than 100 million Americans have medical debt, according to an NPR investigation. With rising hospital and drug prices, high out-of-pocket costs, and insufficient insurance coverage, medical bills can follow people for years. But some local governments have been stepping in to help chip away at the problem. Lawmakers in Northwest Ohio want to spend up to $1.6 million to pay off medical debt for thousands of residents. Toledo City Councilwoman Michelle Grimm has been pushing the measure. And today she talked to Eric about it.
Last week, Toledo City Council approved $800,000 to eliminate medical debt for Toledo citizens. And it will also be a partnership with the Lucas County Commissioners, who will also put in $800,000 for a combined $1.6 million to cover the entire county. And that would be an estimated 41,000 citizens and wipe out up to $240 million in medical debt. And how we're doing that is we're partnering with RIP Medical Debt. They are a national nonprofit charity who works with hospital systems, physician groups, the secondary market to purchase medical debt, pennies on the dollar, and then they just relieve that debt. And for those who qualify, they will get a letter in the mail saying their debt's been canceled.
So RIP Medical Debt will leverage the money you guys are giving to help wipe away that larger figure of debt.
Correct.
So talk about the burden of medical debt on some of your constituents and how removal might be a game changer for many people.
Yeah, so a lot of people are suffering because of the pandemic. There's still a lot of lingering effects of the pandemic and also inflation. Grocery bills are higher. Gas prices are higher. Rent is higher here in Toledo and mortgages are higher in Toledo. We just, you know, had a big housing boom like the rest of the country. So, you know, medical debt is the number one reason that people go bankrupt. And we're helping people put food on the table. We're helping people pay their mortgages, their rent, pay their utility bills. We're also helping people go back to the doctor because a lot of people avoid going back to the doctor because of all of their growing medical bills. And so we're kind of helping aid in that economic recovery for Toledoans and other Lucas County residents.
Michelle, what do you say to some fellow council members, you know, who voted against this measure saying, look, this is important, but we should prioritize additional support for first responders, police and fire and medical, repairing our streets and our parks. What do you say to them?
I think everyone knows someone who's had medical debt. And now we're seeing a lot of studies talking about how it exacerbates social determinants of health, like putting food on the table, paying rent, paying utilities, and it also exacerbates evictions. We have a high poverty rate here in Toledo, and this is going to be a very simple idea to aid in the economic relief of Toledoans and Lucas County residents.
Do we know yet what debt will be forgiven and who will be eligible?
So the eligibility is source-based. So it's based on which hospitals participate. And RAP Medical Debt has been in communications with a couple of hospitals in the area. And I'm unable to disclose more details about that. But so once they are able to purchase that debt, it'll be individuals who are up to 400% of the poverty level.
Chicago has done something similar with medical debt. I mean, what do you think other cities can learn from these experiments?
Yeah, I think they can learn that healthcare is a really important investment for citizens. Healthcare is very much in the interest of local governments. It helps people, you know, helps the health and welfare of citizens. I think it's that our responsibility. And I think this model, the Toledo model, is going to go far and wide. And I already have a lot of elected officials on Twitter reaching out and saying, how can we do this in our city? And I really think it's going to catch on, and a lot of people are going to look at this model and say, hey, we need to do this here.
That's Toledo City Councilwoman Michelle Grimm. She is leading the effort to wipe away medical debt for some of her constituents. Michelle, we hope other cities catch on to this. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
After the break, New Mexico just voted to enshrine funding for education in its state constitution. Two teachers tell us what that means to them. Here's another ballot measure passed last week that might not have been on your radar. Voters in New Mexico approved a plan to put more money toward education. New Mexico ranks last among the 50 states in providing for child well-being, according to the Annie E. Casey Foundation. But that could change, as public schools and early childhood programs in particular are now set to get an additional $150 million or so every year. Here's senior producer Ashley Locke with more on that.
So all that money is on its way after voters in New Mexico approved a ballot measure this month called Constitutional Amendment 1. It directs money across the state to the youngest learners and the people who care for them. The cash comes from a trust. It's funded by gas and oil revenue. It's unique. And it was first put into place as part of New Mexico's statehood more than 100 years ago. Andrea Serrano is executive director of OLE, a nonprofit for working families. And she's been fighting for this kind of funding for years. She sent in a voice memo from an election night watch party celebrating the win.
This means so much change for New Mexico. This means a path for our children to have quality early education, home visiting, daycare. This means increased wages for early educators.
Now, New Mexico has taken steps to help families during the pandemic. You might recall they are providing free daycare to folks, but that's been temporary. And in the years to come, this new funding stream will be guaranteed.
Andrea Serrano also connected us with some educators to share their personal stories. Ivy Del Natachu teaches three-year-olds at Childco Day School in Albuquerque, and her son Casey Pantea teaches 4- and 5-year-olds at the same school. They spoke to Deepa Fernandez.
Ivy Del, I'm going to start with you. What does it mean for families in New Mexico that there's going to be millions of dollars set aside for early childhood education?
It's going to really benefit the children. This movement is really something that's going to benefit the generation.
And we should tell listeners that this constitutional amendment is not just free preschool. In fact, we don't know what it will be, but it will be services for birth to 5, things like home visiting, as well as access to early education. And one of the things you've been actively involved with is fighting for higher wages for early educators. And just so people understand, how much do you get paid?
Before the pandemic, it was $10 an hour. Now that with the relief monies and all the recognition that we're getting, the funding coming in, I'm making $17 an hour right now.
Which I think kind of comes out at about $34,000 a year. And yes. And that's for full-time work as an early educator. Why do you think teachers need more than that?
Teaching is a stressful job, especially with this age. We're here at their most critical time of development. And so everything's brand new to them. So it gets frustrating. But we also do lots of paperwork to help the child grow, like referrals and lesson plans. I mean, just as a public teacher duties, we also have those. So I feel that with all that, we and our educational levels, we have all different kinds of educational levels. So we do deserve this higher wages.
Mm. I mean, I think what many people don't really understand is many early educators do have associate's degrees or bachelor's degrees and even higher. I'm wondering if you can talk about the effect of the low wages on you and your colleagues and your ability to do the work.
Yes, it does affect us. Some of my colleagues have two jobs. So they leave here and they go to an evening job. And I used to have two jobs until my son and I moved in together. But it does affect the living situation. You know, you have to pay one bill at one time and wait for it to pay for another bill. And I think with these low wages, a lot of the teachers really know how to learn how to budget their finances.
We've also heard both in New Mexico and around the country that, you know, many early educators live on the edge of poverty and they rely on public assistance programs. Has that happened to you?
Yes, it has. I had to apply for food stamps. So yes, a lot of us have to, apply for the assistance just to get by.
And then I guess if you get a small raise, sometimes that can affect your ability to actually qualify for some of these programs.
Yes, the raises that we get is going to affect our public assistance. But then again, I feel proud that I will be off and, be able to provide for my family without the assistance.
Casey, I'd love to bring you into the conversation. You grew up seeing your mom struggle financially. And now you have two young kids of your own and you're married and you all live together in a house with your mom to save money, as she was just telling us. What inspired you to become a teacher for our very littlest learners, just like your mom, even though you knew growing up how challenging it has been to make ends meet for her?
Well, I think your heart really has to be in it, because if it's not, you wouldn't want to stick around for low wages and, people looking at your career as, you're just a babysitter. And as I watched her grow up, the enjoyment she had, teaching children and, the story she brought back. And just growing up, I didn't have a lot of, male positive role models. So, I always looked at her as like, oh, wow. So, once there was an opening at her work, I was quick to jump at it. And it's been 15 years and I've never left. So,
And let's be real, there really aren't many men in early childhood education. But as you mentioned, male role models are really important at a young age. How has it been being, I'm guessing, one of the few men in the field?
Yes, it's funny to see, because, when families do come in to see the center or school, they're like, oh, wow, a male in the classroom, and it just gives it a different feel. And I know I've got a lot of, positive feedback from parents saying, oh, she loves school. Oh, she likes to come. She loves you so much, or he loves you so much. And, the feeling it gives you, it just makes you proud. And knowing that you could be that for a child, that just gives me the rewarding feeling.
But I imagine you've had to make sacrifices to do this kind of work.
Yeah, financially, it was tough at times, Like my mom said, we did have to move in. My wife actually was a early childhood educator as well.
Wow, it really runs in the family.
Yeah, so she did leave because, the low wages, and she loved what she was doing. She didn't want to, but yet we were sitting, wondering what could we do and what can we do. So even before all the pandemic and everything, the relief funds, I was actually thinking about leaving early education to go find something that paid better. But, you know, with all this coming up, it is worth working for with children when at first we didn't make wages where we could hardly live on to now we're at least making a at least decent, you know, it could be better, but we're happy with what we can get.
I'd love to ask you, Casey, because, you know, we hear statistics like New Mexico ranks, you know, 50th in child well-being, and you're on the front lines. How much of a difference will this ballot measure that has now passed make, do you think, in the well-being of children?
I mean, with all that it comes with, you know, all the benefits they will get, like having outside organizations that can help, you know, early with children that have disabilities with like delays in their learning, they get, you know, help with all that. So, you know, I know the children will benefit greatly from what's going on now.
Ivadel, you are also a grandmother. You're a mother, you're a grandmother. What do you think parents of young children need right now?
Young children, yes, they do need like a safe place to be, and we do provide that. Even them that are the families that are enrolled in the daycare, they are also facing financial difficulties. So sometimes the kids come and say, "I didn't have dinner last night because we didn't have food." So that's where we provide.
And my last question for both of you, there is going to be money coming now to the early childhood field in New Mexico. Where do you want to see that money go? Ivadel?
For sure, we want accountability for this money, and we definitely want it to go to the teachers and to develop programs that will assist children, to becoming successful in their learning and their growing up.
Casey?
I just hope that it goes to, you know, teachers, because we are in the front lines daily, every day with them, you know. Sometimes, I know it's hard to believe, but most times we're there more than the parents, you know. They're there with them weekends, after schools, we're there with them all day, you know. So I would like to see it go to teachers, but as well as programs where they, you know, children with any kind of disabilities, delays, or any kind of help families or children would need. That's where I would hope the money would go.
Ivadel Natachu and her son, Casey Pantea, are both early childhood teachers for 3 to 5-year-olds at Child Code Day School in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
After the passage of Constitutional Amendment 1 to fund early childhood education in New Mexico, there are still details to be worked out, and the cash likely won't be doled out until at least next year. But organizers like Andrea Serrano with Olé are hopeful about the changes ahead after this historic election.
We are thrilled. This is a new day for New Mexico. We're the first state in the nation to enshrine early education in our state constitution.
That's just one of the many stories we've got following up on the results of last week's elections. For closer looks at everything from ballot measures on abortion to how the political parties are recalibrating, head to hereandnow.org and click 2022 election. And subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already to keep up to date. This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Hafsa Qureshi, Ashley Locke, and James Mastromarino with help from Devin Speak. Gabe Bullard and Jill Ryan edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Patrick O'Connor. Mike, Max Liebman, and I wrote the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.